land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway, saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Solidarity Spokane on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane 88.1 and 92.3 FM.
I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me, a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting as the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, and the voice coming chanting, and the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
We broadcast acknowledging that we are on the ancestral lands of the Spokane Tribe of Indians and a multitude of tribes who are connected through shared history of trade, celebration, and resources. We make this acknowledgement to pay respects to their elders past and present whose knowledge remains on this land. Please take a moment to consider the many legacies of violence, displacement, migration, and settlement that bring us together today. Join our community as we continue to learn about these truths that we may take direct action in solidarity with Native people towards restorative justice. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm your host, Kat. I'm joined in the studio today by Lisa Brown, candidate for mayor of Spokane. Lisa earned her bachelor's degree in economics from the University of Illinois and her master's and PhD in economics from the University of Colorado Boulder. Lisa has worked as a professor of organizational leadership at Gonzaga University. She was later appointed chancellor of Washington State University Spokane, where she oversaw the creation of the first medical school in the WSU educational system and the second of its kind in the state. She served terms in both houses of the Washington State Legislature. In the House, she served as Minority Whip, and in the Senate, she was the first female Senate Majority Leader. During her time in the legislature, she served on the committees on Transportation, Revenue, Human Services, Children and Family Services, and the Rules Committee. She sat on the board of the YWCA, and most recently, she served as the director of the Washington State Department of Commerce. She is now running against incumbent mayor Nadine Woodward. With primary ballots due in 1 week, I am honored she has taken the time out of her busy schedule to speak with us here today. For more information on how you can vote, please visit SpokaneCounty.org/elections. Thank you for joining us today, Lisa.
Kat, thank you so much for having me with you this afternoon.
It's a pleasure to have you. So let's talk shop. So I know that there are a ton of issues that are coming out in this campaign, and there are many that will get a lot of attention on the mainstream media, such as homelessness and public safety and all of that. And I definitely want to get to some of those questions for you. But I understand as well that there's another issue that you've spoken about and that you've been involved in, and that is domestic violence. It's a silent issue that really doesn't receive enough attention. And Bob Lutz once said it was the number one issue affecting our communities in Spokane, particularly women and children. As a survivor myself, it matters to me as well. So what do you believe is causing this? And, you know, do you find that this is unique to Spokane because of geography, or is this a unique problem to us? And what can we do as a community to help stand in solidarity with victims and help perpetrators reform their behavior and even prevent it from happening in the first place?
Well, thank you so much, Kat, for bringing up this really significant issue, because there has been so much emphasis on public safety in this campaign, with almost no attention paid to one of the most serious types of violence in our community, and that is the family violence, of domestic violence, that often becomes intergenerational trauma, and that is a cycle that can and should be broken by both talking about it as well as creating safe spaces in order to address it, and places for people to recover and continue to thrive without negative impacts to their future. I, interestingly, first became involved in the issue in Spokane when I first moved here, and that was long before I was on any boards or involved in anything organized, but I was teaching economics out at Eastern and became involved with a group of activists who actually helped plan Spokane's first Take Back the Night March, which was to bring awareness of domestic violence to our community. And interestingly, throughout my public service in the legislature, I worked on the issue, and then most recently at Commerce, we have the Office of Crime Victims Advocacy and administer grants to community organizations that are working to educate the public and to help the victims of domestic violence.
That's wonderful. And I understand I might be wrong about this, but they do, those domestic violence situations do take a lot of bandwidth from our local police department and demand a lot of attention from first responders.
Absolutely. And I think that it's been something of a neglected issue in this campaign, because the focus by the current administration has really been on crimes potentially connected to homelessness and drug addiction. And certainly neighborhoods are concerned about property crimes and the lack of consistent response to those. I believe the last statistic issued by the chief was 42% of those calls being responded to. But family violence is something that has this intergenerational impact and really deserves a lot more of our attention. It's clearly tied into the economic insecurity faced by so many families in Spokane. Nearly a third of our families are facing challenges of rising rents and or mortgages and or difficulty even locating affordable housing. And those economic insecurities often manifest themselves in continuation of patterns or reoccurrences of the kind of trauma that people have been subjected to with domestic violence, and that can continue if we don't break the cycle.
Do you believe that that issue, which was described as a number one health issue facing us, is related to the increase in codependent use disorders and in homelessness directly?
Certainly, to untangle the impacts of the economic insecurity and the ways that people respond to the trauma or the adverse childhood experiences that they have had in their lives is something that you can't solve with just a simple slogan. And I would say that that is the approach of the current mayor, to talk about law and order. And that brings to mind, in most people's minds, things very different than the types of public education approaches and support for families that we need to put forward if we really want to break the cycle of domestic violence. One of the things that I hope to be able to accomplish as mayor is to bring people together around a collective impact goal of having more of our children nurtured and ready for kindergarten. Only about a third currently show up at kindergarten, really ready for what that experience has to offer. And those are programs that would support working families, that would support new parents, that would address addictions and family violence. And I believe that could be a great way for our community to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Expo by really focusing on those families and our ability as a community to create a safe environment for all children and all families.
Thank you very much for your opinion on that. And that leads into a segue of an issue that has kind of dwarfed any others in the campaign, which is this issue of homelessness and public safety. It was very prevalent in the last election as well and has been with us for some time. And there's been a lot of back and forth in it. And with regard to homelessness, the number of people counted as living on the streets or in shelters in our county has risen by 50% over the last 4 years. So it's a problem getting continually worse. And working in social services myself and directly with unhoused individuals, it matters very much to me. What are we doing that's not working? And what do you think we should be focusing on? You've touched a little bit about it. Is there anything more that you think we can be doing?
Absolutely. First of all, the good news is that we can come together and we can use proven methods of meeting people where they're at and offering solutions that lead to a path of stability. And I would encourage people to go to my website, lisabrownformayor.com, take a look at our public safety plan and how addressing homelessness is very central to that plan. The model that I'm suggesting has components of navigation centers, street medicine teams, and expanding housing supply and upstream interventions to prevent homelessness. But what hasn't been going right? The current administration has not landed in over 3 years on a plan or pulled people together to help implement a coordinated approach to homelessness. It's been more of a moving homeless people. First, there was, if we don't have services downtown, perhaps there won't be homeless people downtown. There was the closure of the Cannon Street shelter, which the city owns. Later, it was opened again. Now it's closed again. This, to me, is symptomatic of lack of a plan and lack of experience in bringing people together and creating that kind of coordinated response that could really make a difference. Secondly, the centerpiece of this administration's response to homelessness is the Trent former warehouse, current warehouse shelter, mm-hmm. that has been, frankly, a financial disaster for the city and is not getting good results and is not equal in scale to the situation of homelessness that we have in the community. And the third piece of this would be just the lack of coordination and the conflict both within City Hall and between the city and the state, rather than working hard on partnerships that could bring additional state funding to the community and that could give us a path forward. So there's a lot to turn around there, but I firmly believe we can do it, that there are models in other communities that we can borrow from, and that we have lots of great nonprofits, churches, volunteers who really believe that we can have both a compassionate and an effective response to homelessness.
And there, you mentioned recently on an interview on The T that you there were public programs that we were not making use of as a city that were offered by the state, but which we've left on the table. Would you talk more about those?
Yes. A couple of years ago, the legislature, understanding how growing lack of affordability in housing and homelessness was growing in communities all over the state, east and west, rural and urban, started a new program called the Rapid Capital Acquisition Program. And the goal was just that, for communities to join together, local governments and nonprofits, and rapidly acquire existing facilities that could then be converted or upgraded into facilities to address emergency housing for homeless people on their way to affordable housing while receiving the services that they may require related to mental health or addiction or employment services. The community of Spokane and Spokane County were slow to come to the table on this. There was one application put forward with a very small local government grant that paled in comparison to what I saw happening in applications coming from Pierce County and King County and Snohomish County and Clark County. And so it's really unfortunate that literally millions of dollars that could have gone or could be constructing affordable housing right now were left on the table by our county and city. Now, not all local governments have been as have failed in this to the same extent. I would point, for example, to Airway Heights. Airway Heights has done a really great job of applying for funds and being awarded funds for affordable housing from Commerce, for home ownership programs for first-time home buyers. And there are also funds for childcare and behavioral health facilities. So certainly, as mayor, one of the things I would do is pay very close attention to opportunities that might be available at the federal or state level to make sure that our region gets its fair share of these resources.
And that influx of capital, if I'm correct, the Trent Shelter is not a city-owned facility. We're currently leasing that. Is that right?
That is correct. And that was actually a personal conversation that I had with our current mayor, explaining that state capital funds go to entities generally that make a commitment to keep those new housing units continuously affordable for 30 or 40 or even 50 years. And so that type of state funding would not go to a leased facility with the state taxpayer dollars going into renovations that would ultimately probably prevent, would benefit a private owner.
Having worked at the Trent Shelter for the better part of a year and a half or 2 years, it does have that. One of the frustrating things for our office is, pardon me, connecting to clients and finding them because they are not very supported. It's very difficult for staff because the turnover is so high. The individuals they're dealing with are often very afflicted with mental health or co-occurring issues. And though the staff gets very exhausted, understandably, especially because that's a 24-hour round-the-clock job. But the facility seemed to lack general sanitation facilities. I mean, people were washing in foot-powered basins where you're pumping water out of a massive recycled, central communal thing. And for lack of a better word, thing, I guess we'll say that. And septic facilities were also just seemingly haphazardly constructed. And so it is a wonder how that is expected to be a permanent solution. And, you know, some of the most sound advice I ever got from a man who was like a father to me was that if you ever get your hands on a dollar, don't put it in a lease because it will all disappear.
Well, in economics 101, one of the things we talk about is sunk costs. And the idea there is just because you've put a lot of money into something doesn't mean that that justifies further investments. So, for example, a car, lots of repairs, you don't just keep putting funding in it because you already have. You have to evaluate going forward what are the costs and benefits. And there are best practices out there for environments that help people build trust and truly transition into stability. And the current configuration of the Trent Shelter just is not that type of a best practice.
Yes, ma'am. I'm speaking with Lisa Brown, candidate for mayor of Spokane. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to be right back after a few messages.
Join me, Captain Maeve, as we head out and about, featuring LGBTQ folk, friends, allies, and all who make Spokane a better place through inclusion, creativity, truth, and beauty. Local stories, conversations, and creations with universal appeal. Out and about, every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on KYRS.
This is your KYRS live and local calendar for July 24th through the 27th. Monday, Imagine Jazz at the Bad Seed and open mic hosted by Lucas Brookbank Brown at the Red Room. Tuesday, Daniel Hall at Riverfront Eats, Carly Osika at Twigs, Dallas K at True Legends, Rosie Zircone at the Rocket Market, Justin Priest at the Wave, Sanguasuga Bog, Cruelty, Vomit Forth, and Gates to Hell at the District, and Lucas Nelson and Promise of the Real at the Knitting Factory. Wednesday, Trombone Shorty in Orleans Avenue with Ziggy Marley at the Spokane Pavilion, Jake Rozier at True Legends, Nalina McShane at the District, open mic at the Checkerboard Bar, and the Roommates Jam at the Red Room. Thursday, B at Magnolia American Brasserie, Tango Volcado at Coeur d'Alene Park, Kyle Mont Cunningham at Craft and Gather, Diary at Big Sky Drinkery, the Ron Green Band at the Highball Speakeasy, and Sole Proprietor at Rock the Nest and Kendall Yards. For an entire hour of Spokane area musicians, tune into For the Love of the Music every Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
The mission of Planned Parenthood is to ensure all people have access to the care and resources they need to make informed decisions about their bodies, their lives, and their futures. Each year, Planned Parenthood delivers vital reproductive health care, sex education, and information to millions of people in the United States and around the world. Information online at PlannedParenthood.org.
Hi, this is Jeremy Whittington from Stage Left Theater. KYRS Thin Air Community Radio provides our region with information that might be omitted, overlooked, or even censored by mainstream media. Your radio station is powered by the communities they serve, and our radio programs are as rich and diverse as the Spokane community itself. Please make a pledge today by texting GIVE KYRS to 44321. Your support ensures that KYRS can continue to celebrate the rich diversity of our community.
You're listening to Solidarity Spokane on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM Thin Air Community Radio. I'm your host, Kat. And for those of you just joining us, we've been speaking with Lisa Brown, candidate for mayor of Spokane, where we've been discussing her work in regional domestic violence organizations and what we can do about homelessness and public safety in our community. Lisa, before the break, we were talking about the Trent Shelter as a leased facility. There are so many moving parts and components to this problem. A question that I have a lot, I have heard a lot from people who are in the community, particularly folks around the downtown area, is that we're very grateful for the permanent supportive housing of Catholic Charities. One of the confusing aspects to it is that it all seemed to get lumped in one particular area, which seems like it's made it very unmanageable, a little difficult to deal with maybe. Speaking for folks that I know in my life and have spoken to around, those facilities have been built and they're not going anywhere. What do you think we can do to address an issue like that? And is there a way to maybe disperse some of that concentration?
I think that is a significant and important issue, and that local government in general in our region has not come together and come up with a good plan, as well as outreach and work with neighborhood councils on proposed facilities. I am hopeful that a regional approach can come together, as has been proposed, for an entity that would combine City of Spokane and county funds and address homelessness and facilities in a regional manner. So we'll see if that happens. There is one piece of this that I kind of want to set the record straight on.
Absolutely.
While I was at Commerce, there were funds that went to create new housing units for people who were living at Camp Hope. And the legislature required that the funding significantly go to not just shelter, but also long-term affordable supportive housing. One of the top proposals that Commerce received in a letter signed by the mayor and former city council president Beggs was a proposal to fund the Catalyst facility in West Hills. The Commerce team informed me that they had chosen to fund that contract partly based on, ironically, the idea that it came in a letter signed by both the mayor and the city council president. And they said, they seldom agree on things. This must be a good project. Mm-hmm. And then after initiating that funding, when the neighborhood had concerns, and I would say justifiable concerns because of other facilities addressing homelessness in the neighborhood, the mayor more or less threw Commerce under the bus and said, go talk to Commerce if you have a problem with this, instead of acknowledging that, in fact, it had been a request from her office signed by her. And so going forward, we need better communication and transparency and honesty in working with neighborhoods and addressing how to site facilities. I know this is not going to be an easy topic, but I feel like it can be handled best by having an open, proactive conversation with neighborhood councils and city council members who represent those neighborhoods.
I definitely want to come back to that word transparency. That's flowing around a lot. Before we move on from the issue of homelessness, there's one other question I had for you, and that is that it seems that libraries are becoming a primary point of contact for individuals that are experiencing homelessness. And our downtown library, since its renovation, has done amazing things for that population. There was a program that I was involved with, Community Court, down Mondays at 10, where individuals who were guilty of, you know, small crimes that would normally land them in jail were able to come, you know, address their legal concerns with the city and then be connected to supportive services that were there ready to meet them. Part of what you were saying about connecting those individuals to point and place resources. COVID slowed that down quite a lot. Unfortunately, it had this really great momentum, and then COVID shut everything down, and now it's been working its way back up. Do you see room for improvement in working on public facilities like the library? Do you believe that there can exist facilities like the library that can serve that purpose, where someone can use a bathroom, can access a phone charger and get out of the heat or the sun for a moment?
We definitely need those type of facilities. I would say we also need a plan for community court, municipal court. There are some excellent programs within our municipal court that give people the opportunity to enter treatment or be diverted from jail in order to make the kinds of changes or engage in the kinds of programs that will help them move their life forward. And due to, again, lack of coordination and collaboration between the city and the county, we haven't really made the appropriate investments in municipal court. So it's great that some of those activities have been able to be carried out at the library, but we also ultimately need a facility that's specifically designed for a municipal court with appropriate safety features built in and services built in. So our downtown, not just for people who are experiencing homelessness or but also for visitors and families that are traveling or visiting downtown, we really do need to be a welcoming place with facilities and wayfinding and services. And that is a partnership that I would like to explore with our Downtown Spokane partnership, trying to understand kind of where they've been and where we could go together. I think there's room for greater partnership there. And I have also talked to small business owners downtown, both who are within kind of the purview of the Downtown Spokane Partnership or right outside of it. And there's just room for more collaboration and extension of that partnership.
Yes, ma'am. And working in legal services for the years that I have has taught me, you know, if you put someone into the criminal justice system, they often come out a criminal. And what I mean by that is not that that is intrinsically on their heart. It's not who they are, but it's a function of the system. And that if you end up with a felony or you end up with other things like that on your record, reentry and reincorporation, employment, even housing become significant barriers to folks. And that can end up leading to a lot more problems down the road. So couldn't agree more. And what mistakes do you believe that we might make in how we frame our view of unhoused human beings?
Well, first of all, studies show that the high rates of homelessness experienced in Spokane are associated with what happened to our housing market over the last few years. That is, housing markets that dramatically change, perhaps from relatively affordable to unaffordable in a short amount of time, and where vacancies in rentals drop precipitously. That's the place where you see high rates of visible homelessness. And there are misconceptions out there that it has more to do with public policies or even weather, although it's hard to understand how Spokane would be put in that latter category, given the extremes of both hot and cold that we experience over the years. But that is a misconception that's out there. The second misconception that I have heard often is that homeless people have come here from other places. I've had an individual swear to me that homeless people were bused here from the southern border, or that they were attracted here because of how luxurious Camp Hope was. The interviews that I've conducted with the homeless three times with the point and time count and the studies done by our own local homegrown researchers at Gonzaga and EWU confirm that about 75 to 80% of people who are unhoused in our region became unhoused while they were living in the region. And that correspondingly 20 to 25% have come from outside the region. And that means that they experienced eviction, divorce, unemployment, disconnect from family and community, sometimes connected to substance abuse or mental health challenges, all kinds of reasons. And there's I guess the simple story is there's no simple story, that each person's experience is unique. One thing we have done relatively well compared to other places in Spokane is we have conscientiously and in a collaborative way taken on the issue of youth homelessness. And we have done a relatively good job of trying to address youth homelessness as soon as possible, prevent it whenever possible, and really create safe places for youth who are experiencing homelessness, whether they came from the foster care system or the juvenile justice system, or from families that didn't accept their sexuality or whatever the case may be. So some of the lessons learned in youth homelessness can be applied to adult and family homelessness. And that's one of the things I hope to do as mayor, as well as attract some of the philanthropic dollars that have gone in to reducing youth homelessness that are out there that will help fund some of the best practices.
A little bit of a pivot now that we've spoken at length about that issue. Is that you mentioned transparency earlier, and there was an interesting comment which was made by the current administration with respect to the Craig Meidel incident. And I know you've received a lot of questions on this, and this has been done to death, but I think it warrants just a little bit of a conversation, and that was that the current mayor didn't initiate an investigation, and the mayor stated that the organizations that were calling for that investigation were anti-police advocates who stated that they wanted transparency. However, that was not really their stated aim. There wasn't really much more elaboration on that. What was your view of the situation, and would you have acted differently?
Well, let me add a little context here. 70% of the people in Spokane voted for the independent office of the police ombudsman. 70%. I mean, it's hard to get 70% of people in Spokane to agree on anything, but they agreed on that because they, whereas we, I respect law enforcement and people who put their lives on the line to protect the public, I also believe that no one should be above accountability or independent investigations. And so we have to keep that as the general context for this, that as that office has been put in place, there are gaps or loopholes, if you will, in accountability, and we can close those gaps. And one of those gaps is that it remains the discretion of the mayor if there is a suggestion that there needs to be an investigation of the chief himself or herself. And so that is a gap in the accountability that I think can and should be fixed.
And you're saying that as mayor, you would cede the authority of the executive to allow more oversight of that position?
Absolutely.
And some critics have painted you in that same light, as anti-police, as and in many ways as a career politician. I don't want to lump both of those into the same question. They're proximal on my sheet that I have before me. So how we have 3 minutes before break, so I'm really not setting you up well here. I'm sorry. How would you respond to those statements?
Well, let's start with the first one, defund the police. That is, frankly, sort of a DC-style attack. There have been polls done that that's an unpopular phrase, so they are associating it with me when there is no evidence to the effect that I've ever called for that. In fact, my public safety plan calls for a funded, accountable, trusted police force that is fully staffed, and our current police force is not. I think we're 70 officers down. So that's a political attack on me that has been, frankly, I think, unfairly applied to me and to the candidate for council president, Betsy Wilkerson. I need people to help make it clear that that is not what I've called for, and it's not consistent with my record, and that the concept of both having a well-staffed and well-trained police force and having dialogue with communities that have historically experienced disparities in the criminal justice system is something that are, those things are very compatible with each other. And under my leadership, we would have police leadership that would welcome the opportunity to build those trusting relationships.
Absolutely. And with respect to the other, I think we'll take that one after the break. 30 seconds is hardly enough.
Sounds good.
I'm your host, Kat. You're listening to Solidarity Spokane. We'll be right back after a quick message.
Come hang out Saturday nights right here on KYRS FM. Saturday nights 10 to midnight with me, Micah Thompson. It's The Witching Hour. We'll be spinning hot molten metal from Black Sabbath to Bolt Thrower and everything in between. Tune up your air guitar and make sure that amp goes to 11. It's gonna get loud.
KYRS is grateful for the many listeners who have donated their vehicles to us. You can join them by donating your unwanted car, truck, minivan, motorcycle, and more. Vehicles are picked up free of charge, sold, and the proceeds help KYRS bring you the programs you know and love. It's easy to donate your vehicle, and it's tax deductible. Just call our toll-free line to arrange a free pickup. 855 KYRS Car. That's 855-597-7227.
Welcome back to Solidarity Spokane. That was a brief break. I'm your host, Kat, and I'm here sitting with Lisa Brown, candidate for mayor of Spokane. And Lisa, just before the break, we were going to get to another criticism that you faced, which is that folks have been saying that you're a career politician and have no investment in Spokane. How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, for 20 years, I taught thousands of students at Eastern and Gonzaga, Econ 101, the economics of women in work, leadership. And that has actually been and was my sort of core professional life when I was also a citizen legislator, because citizen legislators go to Olympia for a few months of the year for a 60 or 105-day session. So resident of Spokane and very engaged in Spokane's neighborhoods, parks, organizations since the 1990s. Lived here as a renter and a first-time home buyer in Perry District, in the Logan District neighborhood, in Lower South Hill, etc. My service in the legislature was, I think, characterized by becoming a champion for Spokane. One little addition to the, or maybe correction to the introduction you gave of me earlier in the program, I was not the first woman to serve as Senate Majority Leader. I was the first woman on the Democratic side of the aisle. Actually, the first woman was from Walla Walla. She was a Republican, and her name was Jeanette Hayner. I loved the opportunity to hear from so many organizations, businesses, and people from Spokane about what their dreams were for this community. And nothing made me happier than working on those things, whether it was funding for the YMCA or the Fox Theater or the motion picture and film tax credit that's helped spur our creative economy here. I also worked hard for issues that I considered fundamental issues of human rights. So I worked for marriage equality, and I defended women's reproductive freedom. And I believe that is also a contrast between me and the current administration. At the Department of Commerce, our mission was to strengthen communities, and we did that through dispersing funds to local governments, tribes, childcare centers, businesses, utilities, and all of that, again, were investments or grants to help communities that were working to improve the well-being for families and neighborhoods. So what I think really happens when I'm called a career politician is that that record and that experience and the experience that I have that I bring to the job is something that my opponent clearly does not have. And so also not much of a record to talk about over the last 4 years. So it ends up being an attack on me for having been in elected office before.
Another issue that you mentioned in a recent interview that has completely missed me up until about 3 or 4 days ago is that there seems to be a little bit of a budgetary implication with the city currently that seemed to matter very much to you. What is that?
Yeah, we have a problem that I have been uncovering over the last few weeks. Essentially, for the last 3 years, the budget that was introduced at the beginning of the year, which is expected to be a balanced budget, was outspent dramatically over the course of the year, opening up a deficit that has been patched up, if you will, by one-time funds. So that's happened 3 years in a row, seriously depleting the city's reserve funds to the point where I estimate we are nearly $50 million below the reserve levels that we should have in various accounts to shore up the general fund in case there is a recession or to meet future obligations. So here we are about to enter year 4 of this administration, and this structural budget deficit has not been acknowledged publicly by the mayor or her administration, and there is no plan for how to address it. So this is a pretty serious situation that we're in, because commitments have been made to levels of service, to collective bargaining contracts negotiated in good faith by first responders and city employees. And it's only fair to them and to the public for us to have a clear sense of how those obligations are going to be met. And so I am calling on the mayor to acknowledge the structural gap, which I think will be at least $12 to $15 million for next year, and to give the public a transparent view of her plans to fill the budget gap and to replenish those reserve levels, which are so low that I think they jeopardize our bond rating and our ability to undertake important capital investments for neighborhoods.
$50 million is not something you find in the dryer.
No, and it's sad because those reserves were built up under different administrations over a long period of time with an approach that generally was invested in by both council and mayor. And that serious turnaround in our financial prospects has happened dramatically over the last 3 years with very little public awareness. And so I'm sorry to be sounding this alarm, but I think it's only fair that we have this conversation before November.
What shocked me so much is that I had heard nothing, Nothing about it. And I speak to people who are generally very well read, very knowledgeable about what's going on with the city. And you know, and even they were pretty floored by that state of affairs. And it doesn't seem to have gotten any attention.
In May, the city budget director that reports to the mayor actually presented at a council, a work session, I think it's called, that there would be a $500,000 surplus in this year's budget. The city council's budget advisor questioned that assessment, and sure enough, within the next month to 2 months, it was acknowledged that instead of a $500,000 surplus, there was indeed an over almost $9 million deficit. And the city council went about passing ordinances proposed by the mayor to patch the gap again. And so I believe there just has not been a general, unfortunately, focus on this by most of the media or the public. And we do need to have this conversation, because these are not easy decisions to make when you have such a seriously and structurally unbalanced budget.
I should say so. Lisa, we are ostensibly a labor show. We have not spent a lot of time talking about that. In the expenditures and contributions reports, which are listed with the state, I noticed your pie chart was the only one that included a section there that said union. Would you care to talk about that?
Well, yes. I fully support collective bargaining and organizing by labor organizations on behalf of their members. I was part of the first faculty union in the state that formed at Eastern Washington University when I was a faculty member there. And I truly believe that labor unions help set the standard that helps create the conditions for the middle class in our country. So I have received the endorsement and support of several labor organizations, the Spokane Labor Council, and several independent or member unions, and also organizations such as the Washington Education Association.
And we're happy to have your support too. It's very, very rare that labor has folks in office or running for office that look out for them. We don't have very much time, and I have so many questions for you. I have about two other pages of things that I wasn't going to get to. Maybe I overprepared. One question that I do want to have time for is kind of the focus of our show, and that is, what does solidarity mean to you? And how will you, if elected, encourage the growth of solidarity between members of our community as mayor? We've spoken a lot about the conflict that there has been between the mayor's office, the city council, between members of the community fighting over the homelessness issue and what to do with it. There is a growing polarization in the country based in political ideology. What does solidarity mean to you, and how will you help foster that?
Solidarity to me means an understanding of how we are all connected on this swirling planet that has multiple challenges right now. And so understanding in a deep way how to relate to each other's interests with a sense of mutuality and respect. For me, it goes back to probably my early activism, which started out with an exploration of the civil rights movement in the United States, growing up in a small, ostensibly all-white town, and trying to understand what was happening in my country. And then it grew to understand more about the women's movement and how an interconnection among social movements, whether it's on behalf of working people or women or Black Americans or others who have been historically marginalized, or how that working together and understanding each other's issues and working for each other's issues is mutually beneficial for all, and that it's not a zero-sum game. It's not pie. I don't know who said that, but I love that they said that. I'm going to look it up and keep repeating it. It's not pie. If my piece is good for me, that doesn't. It's not something that diminishes your piece. Truly working on behalf of basic economic and social justice for all people in our country and on our planet is something that is a positive that creates more connections between us. So that's my understanding of solidarity, that it's not a transactional relationship. Like when I go to a labor union and ask for their support, I'm not saying, please support me and then I will do what you want. I'm saying it from a perspective of, I want to acknowledge your fundamental rights to organize as workers and to collectively bargain for the well-being of your members and families. And I would appreciate your support because you understand my essential values and what I will stand up for as an elected official.
I think that's very well said. You mentioned earlier that you would ask of folks for them to help you in your endeavor. What does that look like? How can people help you if they were so inclined?
This campaign is going to feature record amounts of expenditures. And unfortunately, a lot of that will come through quote-unquote independent expenditures, political action committees that will engage in mostly negative attacks on me. So the way that that can be counteracted is by people getting involved, volunteering, making an endorsement, talking to their friends, especially helping young people get committed to voting and understand the process of voting. And of course, contributions are welcome because we utilize those to do mail and to reach out to voters. So that's truly grassroots support. The more people who get engaged at that level, and we have over 1,000 so far, almost 90% of which are from within the city limits of Spokane. So speaking to KYRS listeners, get engaged based on the issues that you care about. Find out what the candidates think about those issues, and would encourage everyone to engage in that civic participation. That will both really is part of what makes me hopeful about the future, but also which will help our city just become the best city that it can be.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today. It has been a pleasure having you, and thank you for your thoughtful responses.
Thanks, Kat.
You've been listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Kat. We'll see you next week, Monday at 4.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The cruelty that's been happening at the Texas border just doesn't seem to stop. Greg Abbott's implementation of the buoy system and the concertina wire on the border is sadly not an immigration policy, and certainly not a strategy that's leading to the deaths of women and children along the border.
The U.S. Department of Justice is threatening to sue Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott if he doesn't take steps by today to remove large barrels and coils of razor wire placed in the Rio Grande River to block migrants from crossing the border. We'll speak to Texas State Senator Roland Gutierrez, and we'll go to Arizona, where the intercepts revealed U.S. Border Patrol agents are holding migrants in outdoor cages amidst a record-setting heat wave.
Inside the walls of the station, I saw roughly 50 migrants being held in a chain link enclosure with very little shade. The temperature that day was 114 degrees. We're currently experiencing a record-breaking and deadly heat wave. And already this month, the remains of 14 migrants have been found in the desert in this area.
Then an historic settlement. New York City's agreed to pay $13 million to protesters victimized by the police during the 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. And we'll look at the new blockbuster film about J. Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb.
Christopher Nolan.